Greetings, ladies and gentlemen of the Fort Collins chapter of Vino and Veritas. This is your host, Dr. Tom Kranewitter. I'm feeling like a renegade, kind of feeling like a revolutionary right now. I am recording in my office in the middle of Denver, Colorado, in blatant defiance of an executive edict issued by our mayor yesterday to shelter in place. That's the length I'm willing to go for you folks, risking arrest so that we can talk about the Federalist Papers. We are in some strange times right now. I was really looking forward to seeing all of you this evening, up at our great venue, Ginger and Baker, but things have changed so quickly. I thought what we would do today is I'm gonna record here some of the big points I wanted to cover for today's meeting in the Federalist Papers. And then we still have, this is meeting number 10. We still have two more left in our series. However, again, things are changing so much. I don't want to make any predictions or promises other than this. I promise you, we will deliver all the material, all the information that we promise to deliver you one way or another. What's the old line? By hook or crook, we will get it to you. I just can't say exactly what form that is going to look like. For this time, we'll do this kind of recording podcast and see how things go. Last time we met, we spent some time talking about the structure of Congress, the design, the meaning of Congress in the Constitution. We were looking at some of the papers in the Federalists in the 50s and the 60s. And I mentioned this, I think is worth repeating. When you read through the Constitution, you step back, what you see is that there are certain qualities or certain virtues that the design of each branch is supposed to encourage. So, for example, the Congress, the main virtue, the main quality, I think it's meant to encourage. And again, this is a human design of a human institution. So it's not a guarantee. It's a design that encourages certain things. In the case of Congress, the Constitution is meant to encourage deliberation, right? I mean, think of the structure of Congress. You have this rather large House of Representatives that is filled with people, representatives who are elected directly by citizens, right? They answer directly to citizens. And to get anything through Congress, for a bill to become a law, it also has to be passed by a Senate. And the Senate is significantly smaller. Members of the Senate have a very different constituency, right? The senators answer to state legislators under the original Constitution. This is before the 17th Amendment. And so what's it going to look like for anything really to pass through those two chambers, the House and the Senate? Likely much deliberation, right? Discussion, reflection, raising, arguments, critiques, responding to these things. That's its purpose. Now, one can look at the way Congress operates today, and that in itself is an entire, that's really a seminar. That's a graduate seminar to look at how Congress was meant to function and its purposes as compared to what it has become today. The creation of the administrative state, all these independent regulatory agencies that have the power to issue regulation, that have the force of law in court, it really has changed much of the work that Congress does. Also, Congress has bound itself, its own members, and people trying to get into Congress with all kinds of campaign finance laws. And so one of the results is, a number of things have happened. So number one, the administrative state, the regulatory state, the subsidy state means that all kinds of businesses now are much more interested in influencing Congress than they were 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, right? When Congress, when the national government in general wasn't doing very much, there wasn't much reason for businesses to invest precious capital in trying to persuade or lobby government. But when government gets in the business of regulating businesses and private property and handing out subsidies and granting waivers from regulations to certain, you know, crony friends, and all those things means that a lot more money is going to politics, and members of Congress now spend way more time than ever before simply hustling to raise money, gin up money one way or another. And you know, you can just flip on C-SPAN sometime and you'll see these ridiculous scenes where a member of Congress is giving a speech in an empty chamber. There's literally nobody there, which means they're really just speaking for either their constituents or some, you know, some special crony partner who that member of Congress wants to demonstrate that they're doing what the crony has paid money for that member of Congress to do. But the point is, when a member of Congress is speaking to an empty chamber, there certainly is no deliberation going on, right? There's no serious discussion and analysis and brainstorming and debate happening. And I would argue that actually happens very little in Congress today. Typically, by the time a bill actually gets to the floor in either the House or the Senate, we're dominated by two. This is the other thing that has changed, right? When the Constitution was written, there were not national political parties. Now we have two major national political parties, the Democrat Party and the Republican Party. And very often, right, that's the way members of Congress line up. They vote with their party. And so typically, by the time a bill gets introduced to the floor, in the House or the Senate, I mean, all the Republicans have already decided what they think about it, and all the Democrats have decided. There's very little deliberation. There's very little debate. There's very little evidence that anyone actually changes their minds. Any members of Congress change their minds because of speeches and discussions and deliberation that go on there. But that, going back to the Constitution, that is the purpose. That is why Congress is designed the way it is, to encourage deliberation. Very different than the virtue or the quality encouraged by the executive branch, right? When you look at the design of the executive, actually that's what we were, last time we met, I think we were on the executive branch. Yeah, meeting number 9. When you look at the executive branch, right, it vests all the executive power, according to Article 2, into a president of the United States, one person. So it's the opposite of deliberation, right? Deliberation requires multiple people talking and thinking and debating. The design of the executive branch really aims at energy, right? What the Federalist calls to be able to act with dispatch, urgency, right? When there's some impending urgent crisis, an army, a navy invading the United States, you need, right, in that moment, you need to act quickly, right then. You know, for some reason, I have this image in my head. Remember that scene on 9/11? President Bush was, where was he? I think he was in Florida, if I remember right. And he was reading to a group of children, students, and his aide leaned over, you know, and explained to him, we're under attack. I mean, a building got hit just a little bit ago, and we thought maybe it was an accident, but now a second one's been hit, and so we know we're under attack. And the point is, you need action, right? Right then. The worst thing in the world would be to form a committee and say, let's form a committee of 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 people, 435 people, and let's try to decide how to respond to this attack, right? I mean, you wouldn't get a response. And that's why the executive branch is designed as it is. Now, that brings us to the third branch, the judiciary. The judiciary, so if Congress is meant to encourage, it's designed to encourage deliberation, and the executive is designed to encourage energy, the judiciary is designed to encourage judgment. And when you think about the three branches, think about the three powers, the legislative power, the executive power, and the judicial power, it really tells you much about government. One of the things I like to remind people, and I think some of you like to remind people, is that government produces precisely zero wealth. We know with precision the amount of wealth that, and when I say wealth, I mean things that people value, right? If you create something, you create food people want, you create medicine people want, you create a computer technology that other people value, that they want to buy, right? You are creating wealth for yourself as you produce things that other people want. Even if you are producing ideas, right? If you are understanding and articulating and teaching ideas that other people value, they're willing to pay you for those ideas, then you are creating wealth for yourself by creating value, producing value for others, something that others value. In the case of Congress, or in the case of government, think of the exercise of the three powers that government has: legislative, executive, and judicial. What do those powers, what can you do with those powers? What can you do with the legislative power? Well, you can pass laws. And, you know, typically what most laws are some form of saying, thou shalt not. The entire criminal code, right, is a thou shalt not do this or do that. And laws, in other words, restrict us. If you start with something like a state of nature, where human beings are just free to do whatever they want to do, what does the law do? The first law limits, right? If you have total freedom in the state of nature, you're free to live however you want, take care of yourself however you want. What is the first man-made law going to do? It's going to limit. It can't add to your freedom. In the state of nature, you have total freedom. There's no way to add to that. So laws tend to restrict and confine our freedom. That's the legislative power. Pass laws that limit what people may do. What's the executive power? That is the power to execute, to enforce those laws, to make sure that people are obeying those laws, right? So we pass a law and say the speed limit is 75 miles an hour on the freeway, on the interstate. And then the executive power sends out cops to enforce that law, to make sure that you're driving no more than 75. Some of us have some problems keeping our speed down within the legal limit. Yeah, I've been getting speeding tickets since I was 14 years old, and I'm much older now, and I still get speeding tickets. But that's the executive power. So what then is the judicial power? The judicial power is the power to judge, and in particular to judge when there are accusations that the law has been broken, right? If a citizen who lives within the law, under the law, is accused of violating the law, there needs to be a judgment, right? One person says, yes, that citizen violated the law. And the citizen says, no, I did not violate the law. There's a dispute. What is needed in a dispute? A judgment. And that is the whole purpose of the judicial power, is to sit and render judgments. Did this person violate the law or not? And occasionally, what we're going to talk about today, the whole idea of judicial review, sometimes those judgments go beyond merely the question of did someone violate the law. Sometimes the judgment includes judgments about the law itself. You know, maybe someone did violate this law. What about the law? Should we even have the law? Is the law constitutional? But all of this is part of, you know, the power to render a judgment. And in order to get judgments that are, again, I want to emphasize, within the realm of human possibility, right? So we're not talking that political science is not a science of precision in the way of, you know, mathematics or engineering. I was just reading an article recently. When I was a kid in high school, I took 4 years of metal shop. I was fascinated by, I just loved all of it, welding and machining, you know, on metal lathes, that kind of stuff. And I was reading about some of these new high-tech milling machines and lathes that can, you know, they can shave down a piece of metal to, you know, these ridiculous tiny little increments of precision. That's not political science, right? So political science just aims in general, in generalities, to try to encourage. And in the case of the judicial branch, the judicial power, we want, as much as humanly possible, we want to encourage dispassionate, disinterested, right, objective judgments. Now that's a challenge to achieve that. I'm acknowledging that up front. But to the degree humanly possible, right, to try to get judges who will sit back and set aside their personal interests, their personal prejudices and biases and all that, and look at the case in front of them, look at the law, look at the facts, and try to render an objective judgment. And one of the ways that the designers, the architects of the Constitution, tried to accomplish that was to create a judicial branch that is to some degree insulated from political pressure. Now, it's kind of a misnomer. It's a mistake, I think, to call the Supreme Court independent. It's not an independent court. I mean, come on, look at the whole process of how justices get to the Supreme Court. They are nominated by a president, right, who typically is, you know, a political animal, and then they have to be confirmed by the United States Senate, which is staffed full of, you know, partisans and political creatures. And so there is political influence there. I don't want to say there's none. It's not completely independent. However, and even once someone gets on the Supreme Court, if they do something really terrible, really outlandish, I mean, they can be impeached and removed. There's nothing in the Constitution that exempts judges or members of the Supreme Court from impeachment. But for the most part, the way the court operates typically in normal circumstances, you know, someone gets appointed to the Supreme Court, and then they're there for as long as they want. It's sort of interesting, in certainly in the 19th century, many justices on the Supreme Court would only serve a few years, and then they would retire from the court and go back to their private, you know, law practice or whatever their business interests were. It's more common in the modern era, the last century or so, to find judges on the court who will serve, you know, their entire lives and either die on the bench from old age or retire at some elderly age. That's a more modern, recent thing. But the point is, from the design features of the Constitution, you can be a judge, a justice. The Constitution actually calls them judges on the Supreme Court. But just by tradition, we've come to calling them justices. So I use the terms interchangeably. But the point is, you can be a judge on the Supreme Court, and you can be there for a long time, and you can render a judgment in a case without any direct political threat, right? No one's going to fire you or take your paycheck away or, you know, punish you in some way because of the judgment you render in a case. And that is how the Constitution attempts to create a Supreme Court that will tend toward cool, dispassionate, sober, objective, disinterested judgments. And when we think about this, the judicial power, one of the most striking features is this power of judicial review. Some of you might be familiar with that phrase, some of you might not. Judicial review is when the court, and in particular the Supreme Court, reviews a law, meaning they sit back and judge whether a law is constitutional or not. That's a judicial review is an instance of the court going beyond merely judging, you know, a disputed question about whether a particular person broke a law, and they turn their judgment from that question to the question of the law itself. Sometimes the court has held that there's a problem with the law, And the most important question is not whether the accused violated the law. The real question is, should the law exist? And this becomes especially important when you think about this in terms of a written constitution that enumerates the powers of Congress, right? So here's Congress, this body that exercises the legislative power, which is the power to make law, pass laws. And the Constitution enumerates, right? It says, you and Congress, you may make these kinds of laws. That's it. If there's a power not in that list, then the Congress doesn't have the power to pass those laws. So it means the way that from the very design of the Constitution, there is the potential for statutory laws, that is, right, laws passed by Congress, typically signed by a president, so there can be, within the framework, within the intrinsic to the design of the Constitution, there can be a difference between statutory law and the law of the Constitution. These two things can oppose each other, right? We can have a Constitution that says, Congress, you have powers A, B, and C, and then Congress goes and exercises power D. But the Constitution doesn't authorize them to exercise power D. There's a conflict. There's a conflict between the law that Congress just passed, exercising power D, and the Constitution, which says, Congress, you may exercise powers A, B, and C, and that's it, period. And that points to this question of judicial review. What should the court do if it is confronted with a case where, you know, and the judges are looking not merely at the facts of the case, but also the laws involved, and they find a law in which Congress exercised power D when the Constitution only granted to them powers A, B, and C, period. What should the court do? Well, this is precisely the question taken up in Federalist Number 78, to which I would like to turn now. I encourage you to turn with me, and in particular to turn to page 464. Six, seven paragraphs into Federalist Number 78 on page 464. And let's see how Publius works his way into this question. Quote, whoever attentively considers the different departments of power must perceive that in a government in which they are separated from each other, the judiciary, from the nature of its functions, will always be the least dangerous to the political rights of the Constitution. This is a line, by the way, I'm not quoting from the Federalists anymore. This is a line that many conservatives and sort of, you know, constitutionalists, constitutional originalists, those types will quote, because what they see is especially over the past 75 years, really since the New Deal, the 1930s, the Supreme Court has been quite active doing all kinds of things. Arguably, you know, creating public policies, exercising legislative and executive powers. Whereas the Federalist Papers here seems to be saying that the judiciary is the least dangerous to the political rights of the Constitution. You know, an obvious example of the concern of constitutional originalists, and I don't want to get into the details of abortion right now, but think about the whole subject of abortion and Roe versus Wade. I mean, one can argue that the Supreme Court single-handedly, right, created a certain right or a concept of a right that was nowhere in the Constitution, right, or anything like that. And so many conservatives and constitutionalists will look at the Federalist Papers and say, see, the judiciary is supposed to be the least dangerous of the branches, and yet here it is today, it's become quite dangerous. And there's certainly some truth to that. And let's read on a little bit and see what exactly Publius means, that the judiciary is the least dangerous. He goes on and says, quote, because the judiciary will be least in a capacity to annoy or injure the political rights of the Constitution. He goes on, the executive branch, think of the president not only dispenses the honors, but holds the sword of the community. The president is the commander in chief of the military. In that sense, the executive holds the sword. The executive can send soldiers with guns and tanks and cannons and all kinds of things. They can blow people up. They can kill people. The president has the sword. The president has the capacity, the ability to act with violence, to exert violent force on others. That's an awesome and terrifying and potentially dangerous power. Publius goes on and points out the legislature not only commands the purse, but prescribes the rules by which the duties and rights of every citizen are to be regulated. So the president holds the sword, the legislature commands the purse, right? How money can be spent. You can get things done when you can spend money on it. Whereas, Publius points out, the judiciary, on the contrary, has no influence over either the sword or the purse, no direction either of the strength or the wealth of the society, and can take, of either the strength or of the wealth of the society, and the judiciary can take no active resolution whatever. It may truly be said to have neither force nor will, but merely judgment, and must ultimately depend upon the aid of the executive arm, even for the efficacy of its judgments. Now, just had an unexpected cough there. There's certainly truth to what Publius is saying. I'll give you a somewhat famous example. When he says that the judicial branch has neither force nor will, the judiciary... it can render judgments. It can render, what we actually call, this is very revealing, what we call the products produced by the court are opinions. That's the technical name. They're opinions, right? The court says, here's our opinion. And they produce a written opinion. And they have no power to enforce that opinion. They can't make anyone do anything. They don't have an army. They don't have money. Nothing, no, neither force nor will. They don't control the sword or the purse of the community. And I'll give you a famous example of this. Some of you might recall the 1954 case of Brown versus Board of Education, in which the Supreme Court declared race-based segregation in public schools to be unconstitutional. I personally think it's a terribly argued opinion, and some other time, if you want to hear more about that, we can go over it. But that is the fact. That is the court's opinion that they handed down. The majority opinion was that race-based segregation in public schools was unconstitutional. And what happened in public schools in the United States over the next decade, for the next 10 years, states continued to have race-based segregation. It didn't change anything. In fact, it's not until Congress gets into this. Congress finally passes the 1964 Civil Rights Act. There's money spent. There's these ugly episodes where, the executive branch, Eisenhower, is sending troops down to enforce desegregation in certain schools. My point is, it's not until the executive and the legislative branches get involved when things start to change. The judiciary on its own, just rendering that opinion, has virtually no effect. And that is an instance of the court seeming very impotent, very weak, very unable to enforce its own decisions. And as I just mentioned, as many thoughtful constitutionalists point out, the court has done all kinds of dreadful things in the last 75 years. In many ways, they seem to be quite powerful. Well, notice that line that we just read. This is right in the middle of page 464 Publius writes, I'm going to read this again, quote, "It may truly be said to have neither force nor will." That is, the court, the Supreme Court, has neither force nor will. Now, I want you to hold your place right there and jump back with me to number 51. Let's see here, if my keep my book together from falling apart. On page 318, this is right in the middle of Federalist number 51, and here's what Publius had to say there. This is the first full paragraph, number 51, page 318. In order, quote, "in order to lay a due foundation for that separate and distinct exercise of the different powers of government, which to a certain extent is admitted on all hands to be essential to the preservation of liberty, it is evident that each department should have a will of its own." Wow. Reread that. Each department, that includes the judicial department, each department of government should have a will of its own. Now flip back to page 464. Publius writes, quote, "It may truly be said that the court has neither force nor will." Ladies and gentlemen, it seems to me there's a contradiction here. Is there not? In one instance, Publius says, each branch, which includes the judicial branch, each branch shall have a will of its own. It's part of the whole separation of power design, right? That each branch has a will so that it can push back against the other branches, help to keep the other branches in its place. That's the whole scheme of separation of powers, right? If you had a branch of government that had no will at all, then the other branches would just roll over them, right? Just steamroll them. And then later in the book, now notice, remember the order of the parts of the government, parts of the Constitution that Publius is unfolding. He's doing this in a very strategic way, right? He began with the House of Representatives, which was the least objectionable part of the Constitution because it was the most democratic, right? That's the one part of the national government that is elected directly by citizens. Then he introduced the Senate, which was, right, slightly less democratic, slightly less populist. Senators were selected by state legislators. Then Publius unveiled the executive branch. And the president is even less democratic, selected in the whole process by the Electoral College. And this is way at the end of the book. I mean, we're almost to the end of the book. We are in number 78, and there's only 85 papers. We're only seven papers away from the end of the book. And he's introducing the judicial power way at the end, which is the least democratic of all the parts of the national government. In fact, it's not democratic at all. The citizens have no influence really on who gets to be president, who gets to be a Supreme Court justice, right? The president nominates, the Senate confirms, then typically they're there for life. And so he has saved this undemocratic and potentially unpopular part of the Constitution for the way end, far end of the book. And I think here he's deliberately being, well, we could say dishonest. That's kind of a harsh judgment. How about if we say he's being a little slippery, deliberately being slippery? It could be that the court, the judicial branch, actually has quite a bit of potential will it can exercise. It can have some pretty important, pretty big influences on our national political life, on questions of public policy, of public law. But Publius here wants to downplay that, at least for the careless readers who are just reading very quickly, right? Not studying, not comparing the different parts of the book, right? If you just read over this the first time, let's see here, the judiciary is the least dangerous of the branches. The judiciary doesn't have any force or any will. Well, that judiciary doesn't sound very dangerous, right? No problem. If you just glance over that. But if you pause and say, well, is that even right? That the that the judiciary is the least dangerous, that the judiciary has no will, that it can't make things happen? Well, notice the first three words of the very next paragraph. What are the first three words in the next paragraph? This simple view of the matter. In other words, the simple view that Publius just laid out in the prior paragraph. That was a simple view. There could be a more nuanced view. There could be a more detailed view. And if you study that more nuanced, detailed view, you might see some significant potential power in the Supreme Court. And one form of that significant potential political power is the power of judicial review. Now, let's be really, really clear here. The power of, I'm going to pause and take a sip of coffee here. The power of judicial review is nowhere granted to the court by the Constitution. It is nowhere mentioned in the Constitution. Publius is going to make an argument. Publius is going to defend. He's going to justify. He's going to say, yes, the court should have, it does have, the power of judicial review. And he's going to make an argument of necessity, that it is, that power of judicial review is intrinsic to a written constitution of enumerated powers. Because as soon as you adopt a written constitution that enumerates and thereby limits the powers of Congress, you create a scenario where you could have unconstitutional laws. You could have Congress passing laws for which there is no constitutional authority. And so you can have a conflict between laws and the Constitution. You know, in that sense, the U.S. Constitution is strikingly, stunningly different from, say, the English Constitution, right? What is the English Constitution? We've talked about this before in our meetings. I mean, there is no written English Constitution. The English Constitution is this smorgasbord of old, edicts issued by the king, exercises of monarchical prerogative power, court opinions, acts of parliament, all wrapped up. And British legal scholars will say that is the British Constitution, right? The British way of governance. Well, that means then an act of, say, Parliament. It really cannot be. If acts of Parliament define the English Constitution, then how can an act of Parliament be unconstitutional? There is no written constitution by which to judge an act of Parliament in England. But here in the United States, we have a written constitution that specifically enumerates the few powers that Congress has, which means there can be a difference between statutory laws passed by Congress and the law of the Constitution. And Publius is going to argue that's a good thing. That is a good thing. Here I agree with him. That is a good thing. You don't want statutes, you know, laws that are passed, whether passed by a Congress or a Parliament or any other kind of legislative body, to just be the ultimate supreme thing and there's no standard by which to judge it. By having a written constitution of enumerated powers, we the Americans, we have adopted a constitution that is the standard by which we can judge statutory laws. And if those laws are in violation of the written constitution, we can say, no, that's unconstitutional. And the question is, should the court have the power to strike down an unconstitutional law or to declare that law to be unconstitutional and thereby inoperative or somehow null? Let's jump forward here and get right into the meat of this. I encourage you to read through on page 466 on your own, where he's raising the very point that we're talking about right now, of, you know, which is more fundamental, the Constitution or a law that gets passed by elected representatives that violates the Constitution. And this is setting up the whole question here of judicial review. Now turn to page 467, right at the top. Publius says, quote, this exercise of judicial discretion in determining between two contradictory laws is exemplified in a familiar instance. So this thing he's going to talk about is rather common. Quote, it is not, well, he actually says that, it is not uncommon that there are two statutes existing at one time, clashing in whole or in part with each other, and neither of them containing any repealing clause or expression, right? So two statutory laws. Suppose a case, I'll give you an example here in just a moment. A case involves two laws, right, that are both statutory laws. They've both been passed by Congress. And the laws contradict each other. He says, in such a case, it is the province of the courts to liquidate and fix their meaning and operations so far as they can, by any fair construction, be reconciled to each other. That is, these two contradictory laws. As far as you can, you know, reconcile them. Reason and law conspire to dictate that this should be done. Where this is impracticable, however, right? If they simply cannot be reconciled to each other, it becomes a matter of necessity to give effect to one in exclusion of the other. The rule which has obtained in the courts for determining their relative validity is that the last in order of time, which is to say the newest law, should be preferred to the first or the oldest law. I'm going to give you an example here. If I was standing in front of you, I would be able to, I think, and if I had my handy, you know, chalkboard or white pad, I could illustrate this a little better. So I just want you to imagine this. Imagine a car wreck on a street, and it's a head-on collision. In one lane, okay, say the, you know, from your perspective looking at the road, the right-hand side of the road, two cars driving right at each other in the head-on collision. And the lawyer for the first car says, hey, look, my guy was in the right. My guy was driving on the right-hand side of the road. And the law, the traffic law, says you're supposed to drive on the right-hand side of the road. It's the other guy's fault, therefore. He was in the wrong lane. The other guy, let's say person A and person B. Person A is driving on the right-hand side of the road. Person A, right-hand side of the road. And he says, the law, right? The law clearly says drive on the right-hand side of the road. I was in the right. Person B, his lawyer does a little research, and you know what he finds? He finds an old law from a long time ago that says, you shall drive on the left side of the road. Holy schmoly! We now have two laws that directly contradict each other. One law says drive on the right-hand side of the road, and the other law says drive on the left side of the road. There's no way to reconcile these two things, right? If one is correct, or if one is enforced, the other cannot be. And the lawyer, right, for driver B says, hey, look, the oldest law here says drive on the left-hand side of the road. So my client is in the right. He was driving on the left side of the road, and it's person A who's in the wrong for driving on the right-hand side of the road. Well, what should a judge do? Right? One law supports the argument of person A. A different contradicting law supports the argument of person B. There's a conflict here. There was a crash involved because of this conflict. Each is arguing that they're obeying the law or a law. What does Publius advise? Publius says the court in that case should give preference to the most recent law. And why? So in other words, if the law says driving on the right, if that's the new law, and the law says drive on the left is really old, the court, the judge, should uphold the law that says drive on the right. So it's going to be the guy driving on the left's fault. Well, why is this? He says, this is still in the same paragraph on page 467. The rule which is obtained in the courts for determining their relative validity, that is, of two contradictory laws, is that the last in order of time shall be preferred to the first. But this is a mere rule of construction, not derived from any positive law, right? So there's not a man-made law out there that says judges must give force to the most recent laws as opposed to the older laws when there's a conflict. He says, but rather from the nature and reason of the thing. It is a rule not enjoined upon courts by legislative provision, but rather adopted by themselves as consonant to truth and propriety for the direction of their conduct as interpreters of the law, as judges. They thought it reasonable that between the interfering acts of an equal authority, that which was the last indication of its will should have the preference. I want you to really think about that last sentence. They thought it reasonable that between interfering acts, that is two contradictory laws, right? Those are interfering acts. They interfere with each other. And those acts were both passed by an equal authority, right? They're both, the law says drive on the left-hand side of the road and the law says drive on the right-hand side of the road. Both were passed by the same legislative body, just at different periods of time, but both passed by a representative legislative body. And so the conclusion is that that which was the last indication of its will should have the preference. What does a legislative body represent? I'm going to come back and I'm going to critique the very argument I'm making right now. But let's just say the will of the people. And let's say the will of the people through their representative legislature, the will of the people in 1800 passed a law saying our will is to drive on the left side of the road. And then a century later, the will of the people changes. And they direct their representatives to pass another law saying, no, drive on the right side. But the older first law was never repealed. It's still in the books. Now we have two laws that contradict each other, both passed by an equal authority, both passed by a representative body, right? A legislative body that represents the people. And since they're both acts of will or willfulness, let's go with the most recent. Why bind ourselves today to the will of the people from 200 years ago? Rather, let's bind ourselves today to a more recent expression of the will of the people. Remember back in 49, however, remember the ultimate goal of government is not for the will of the people to rule over everything. It's for the reason of the people, not the willfulness. And this becomes really a peculiar thing when you ask the simple question, okay, so I want to make sure that we're real clear here. Publius has just said in the case of two laws that contradict each other, and both are applicable in a particular case, what the court should do, what judges should do, is they should ignore the old law and uphold the more recent law, the newer law. Well, you know, I've just done this whole thing setting up law A and B with, you know, drive on the right-hand side of the road versus drive on the left-hand side of the road. Just, it's really clear, I think, to envision that. Let me give you a different situation. Suppose Americans pass a law in 1787 and they call it the Constitution. They adopt it. They ratify it. They say, this is our law, the Constitution. And the Constitution, I'm not standing in front of you here, so I'm going to be a little inaccurate with my language just to make the point clearer verbally over this podcast. The Constitution says you in Congress, you may not pass laws about health insurance or health care in the United States. You have no power over that. Okay, that's one law, the Constitution, that says Congress has no power over health care. And then in 2010, a representative body of the people, Congress, passes the Affordable Care Act, which legislates all kinds of things about health insurance and health care in the United States. there's a conflict, right? There is a conflict between Obamacare and the United States Constitution. The United States Constitution does not grant to Congress any power to pass that kind of law, and Congress went and passed that kind of law. There's the conflict. Now, according to the rule he just gave us, Publius, a judge sitting on the Supreme Court should uphold the most recent law. That would mean uphold Obamacare and ignore the Constitution, unless the Constitution is somehow more serious, more weighty, more important, more meaningful than a modern law that contradicts it. So he's going to try to make that case. He says in the next paragraph, this is on page 467 still in 78. Publius writes, but in regard to the interfering acts of a superior versus a subordinate authority of an original and derivative power, the nature and reason of the thing indicate that the converse of the rule, right, the opposite of the rule is proper to be followed. They teach us that the prior act of a superior authority ought to be preferred to the subsequent act of an inferior and a subordinate authority. And accordingly, when a particular statute contravenes the Constitution, right, or contradicts the Constitution, it will be the duty of the judicial tribunals to adhere to the latter, to the Constitution, and disregard the former, the particular statute that contradicts the Constitution. What do you think? Are you satisfied with that? He said, the conclusion, to be clear, is that when there's a contradiction between a law and the Constitution, and by definition, since the Constitution is the first law, right, it creates Congress, then all statutory laws passed by Congress, by definition, will be newer than the Constitution, right? And that's true. There is no U.S., you know, statutory law that is older than September 17th, 1787. It was the date that the Constitutional Convention finished, you know, writing the Constitution. All the laws passed by Congress came after that. So the Constitution is older than all the laws. And up in the paragraph above, Publius said, well, in the case of two contradictory laws, judges should uphold the newest one. But here, if it's a new law versus the old Constitution, the opposite should be done. Judges should uphold the old Constitution and disregard the new law that contradicts it. And my question to you is why? Isn't the Constitution a law? It's a law, right? It's an old law. What is Obamacare? A new law. And Publius just made the argument when an old law and a new law contradict each other, go with the new law because it's a more recent expression of the will of the people. And I don't know about you, but I don't find all of these adjectives in this paragraph we just read very convincing. He's making the argument that he says, go back and look at that paragraph. When there are interfering, right, or contradictory acts of a superior versus and a subordinate authority. So what he's saying there is the American people of 1787 who ratified their Constitution, they were somehow superior to members of Congress today who pass Obamacare. Members of Congress are somehow subordinate. Members of Congress are somehow have a derivative power that's not, you know, not original like the original people. The original American people who ratified the Constitution. But isn't it also true that, I mean, who authorizes Congress? We do, we the people. So if you say, look, an act of Congress is an expression of the will of we the people, and the Constitution was an expression of the will of we the people. In that sense, they're equal authorities. The American people in 1787, what did they will? They willed the Constitution. What did for the sake of argument here, let's just say, some of you right now, I know you're banging on your you're banging on your desk saying, but you know, not everyone supported Obamacare. Let's say they did, for the sake of argument. Let's say all Americans supported the Affordable Care Act passed. I think that was in 2010, wasn't it? 2009, 2010. And for the sake of argument, let's say every member of Congress voted for it. So that it really was an expression of the will of the American people. Why then should a court strike down or ignore or nullify Obamacare and uphold the old Constitution if they both represent the will of the people, but Obamacare is an expression of the will of the people in 2010? Wouldn't we rather be governed by the will of the people in 2010? That's much more recent in time than the will of the people in 1787 or 1789. That's a long time ago. We don't have anything in common with them. Why should we be bound by the will of the people from over 200 years ago? Here's what I'm suggesting to you. If you conduct this analysis on the level of willfulness, the will of the people, and you compare various expressions of willfulness, the will of the people in 1787 versus the will of the people in 2010 versus the will of the people today in 2020, it seems to me, in terms of willfulness, the most recent right expression of the will is probably the one to go with because it's more recent. It's more relevant. Doesn't mean it's better. Doesn't mean it's more rational, right? It's just willfulness. If you compare this whole argument, though, in 78, if you tie it back to that discussion of number 49, you know, I've been writing this on the easel and the white pad repeatedly, that what the argument of 49 is, that the reason of the public should rule over government and government should rule over the passions of the public, right? It's the rule of reason over passion, or it's the rule of reason over willfulness. What we want to be governed by ultimately is reason, not willfulness, not passion. And the Constitution is an embodiment of reason. It's an embodiment of reason because it understands the limits of human reason. Does that make sense? That the Constitution is eminently reasonable, first and foremost, because it acknowledges the limits of reason. It says, look, I mean, what's the most reasonable understanding of reason? What's the most reasonable understanding of anything is to understand what a thing is. And to understand what a thing is includes understanding what it is not. And what human reason is not, is it is not perfect. It is not omniscient. It is not perfect. And therefore, no human beings, right, it's because they're not perfectly rational, perfectly reasonable, no human being should be trusted with total power. And what does the Constitution do with power? It limits and separates it. That renders the Constitution an eminently reasonable document. Now, if you start with that premise, that the Constitution is reasonable, and then you say, and this modern law, you know, I'm using the Affordable Care Act, but we could toss out dozens, hundreds of modern pieces of legislation that contradict the Constitution. If we say that the Constitution is eminently reasonable and this modern law, the Affordable Care Act, contradicts or contravenes the Constitution, then we're in a position to say a judge or a court should ignore or strike down the Affordable Care Act because it is less reasonable than the Constitution. If the Constitution is reasonable, then an unconstitutional law, by definition, is less reasonable than the Constitution. Now we have, by tying, by anchoring, by taking this argument of 78 and stretching the hook back to 49 and tying these two things together, the idea of reason over willfulness or reason over passion, and tying that to this argument for judicial review that we should uphold an old Constitution because it's reasonable over and against a new piece of legislation that is unreasonable because it's unconstitutional. And I'm going to suggest to you that within the context simply of number 78, I personally don't think Publius does his argument justifying judicial review. I do not find satisfying. I think it requires being hooked back to that argument in number 49, and then the whole thing makes sense. When you do that, I then buy it. I buy it. I say, yeah, I agree. If the Constitution is rational, if it's reasonable, if it's good, if it's wise, then it's not merely an act of the will of the people in 1787. It's an expression of human reason. It's anchored in truth. And so a more modern piece of legislation that contradicts it would be, by definition, less reasonable. And that's why the court ought to disregard an unconstitutional law and uphold the Constitution. Not because one is newer or older, but because one is more reasonable and the other is less reasonable. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the defense of judicial review, which is in many ways when you think about popular or populist government that derives its authority from the people, whether you call it a democracy or a republic or any other phrase, the point is a government that the people have to authorize what it does. Then this idea of judicial review is stunning, is it not? I mean, it's striking. It's so anti-democratic. Unelected judges with this power to strike down a law that the people authorize through their representatives. How do we think about that? We think about that by saying, yeah, that's right. Because the goal of our government is not to enforce the will of the people. It's not. Because the will of the people very often is unjust. It's terrible. It's destructive. Very often what the people want to do is, you know, the majority wants to hurt the minority. The goal of good government is to form a reasonable government, a just government that offers equal protection of the laws for the rights of all citizens. That's different than simply doing what the majority wants or what the will of the people is. And in that case, if we say our goal is not to do whatever the will of the people wants, but rather to offer equal protection, to be reasonable, to be just, then we want this very undemocratic feature of judicial review. We want a court that has the power to apply the brakes, right? When there's an unconstitutional, unjust, unreasonable piece of law that's been passed, we want one part of the government, the judicial part, to have the power to apply some brakes and say, nope, I'm not going to do that. And in that sense, judicial review really is sort of a last-ditch effort of a way for the people to be protected against themselves. When they authorize their representatives to pass unconstitutional, unjust, unreasonable measures, judicial review is sort of a last gasp measure for some part of the government to say, nope, you don't get to do that. That's unreasonable, unjust, that hurts people, that violates rights, when our whole job here in government is to protect rights. Alrighty, I hope this held together. I hope this made some sense. Happy to answer any questions if any of you have any. We will be communicating. We'll be watching the situation. We'll be talking with our friends at Ginger and Baker. I'm not real sure as of right now at this moment how we are going to put on the last two Vino and Veritas events and wrap up the Federalist Papers, but we'll get it to you one way or another, I promise. And in the meantime, please stay safe, be healthy. You know the drill. Wash your hands and take care of yourselves. And I look forward to seeing and talking with all of you again soon. Thank you. Have a great rest of your day.